5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. British Finance Minister George Osborne says the country's economy is fundamentally strong and that Britain remains open for business following the historic vote to leave the European Union.
People need to know the fundamentals are strong. We have dealt with the immediate challenge of an unexpected vote as far as financial markets are concerned because we had in place detailed contingency plans.
Speaking in London Monday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry cautioned the European Union against angry, vengeful behavior against Britain. Meantime, financial services company Standard & Poor's removed the United Kingdom's coveted AAA status on Monday because of the Brexit vote, which also dropped Britain's rating. Sky News says Moody's agency is expected also to downgrade Britain's rating. Advocates for abortion rights in the United States are celebrating the U.S. Supreme Court's decision Monday, ruling that states had no right to curb the rights of women to end their pregnancies by imposing undue burdens on them to limit their access to abortion clinics. The 5-3 decision overturned a law in the southwestern state of Texas similar to that enacted in other states. The decision is likely to be reverberating throughout the U.S. presidential campaign taking place in the U.S. Islamic State militants are claiming responsibility for several bombings Monday that killed at least 42 people in southern Yemen. Yemen's years of instability, including the current conflict between the government and Houthi rebels, have allowed militant groups to control part of the country and carry out attacks. The United Nations is leading peace talks with the goal of creating a new unity government that can reestablish control in Yemen, but so far there has been no agreement. This is VOA News. Israel and Turkey have reached a deal to normalize ties, ending a 6-year rift. Dorian Jones has more on what the agreement means.
Turkish Prime Minister Binali Yildirim announced the countries will restore their ambassadors as soon as possible. The re-establishment of full diplomatic relations follows more than a year of secret negotiations. Relations collapsed when Israeli commandos killed 10 Turkish activists who tried to sail to Gaza, which was under naval blockade in 2010. Under the deal, Yildirim said Israel will pay families of the dead activists $20 million in compensation. Dorian Jones, Istanbul.
French prosecutors have opened a manslaughter probe into the May 19th crash of an Egypt Air jetliner that went down in the Eastern Mediterranean, killing all 66 people on board. Prosecutors stressed the inquiry was launched as an accident investigation and not a terrorism probe. There was no distress call from the pilots and no one has claimed responsibility for causing the crash. In a related development, memory cards recovered by the Egyptian investigators from the plane's flight recorders arrived in Paris on Monday. They hope French engineers can salvage critical data about the crash. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama continuing her 6-day trip promoting education for girls in Morocco on Tuesday. Ms. Obama visited a leadership camp for girls in Liberia Monday, part of an effort to promote girls' education in Africa. First Lady traveling with her 2 teenage daughters and her mother. Their 6-day trip also includes a stop in Spain. Obama's Let Girls Learn initiative addresses obstacles such as forced marriage, poverty, and violence that keeps millions of girls globally out of school. The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, says nearly 70 million children under the age of 5 could die between now and 2030 if governments and their partners don't step up efforts to meet development goals. The findings issued in UNICEF's State of the World's Children's Report, urging governments, donors, and NGOs to focus on the most disadvantaged children and close the gap, giving young people a better chance of a bright future. The report raises the alarm for children in sub-Saharan Africa, where 2 out of 3 live in poverty, and most have had less than 4 years of schooling. The United Nations, rather than the U.S., has sworn in its first ambassador to Somalia in 25 years. Ambassador Stephen Swartz took the oath of office in Washington on Monday. The U.S. pulled out of Somalia just over 2 decades ago after militiamen shot down a U.S. military helicopter, killing 18 soldiers. I'm Michael Brown reporting in Washington.
That's the latest world from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, in for James Batty. Today is Tuesday, June 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama visited Liberia, where she highlighted the importance of girls' education.
Go to secondary school, go to university if you can. And then when you do all that, I want you to continue to be the leaders that you are and come back to your communities and find other girls just like you.
The U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama speaking to students at a school in Liberia. The first U.S. ambassador to Somalia in 25 years is sworn in. The U.S. pulled its diplomatic presence and forces out of Somalia in 1993. Zimbabwe's former Prime Minister and Movement for Democratic Change, MDC, founding president Morgan Tsvangirai, says he has colon cancer.
On the 6th of May, he went to South Africa and he was diagnosed with cancer of the colon. But as you know, there are several procedures that are involved after a diagnosis.
Luke Tamborinyoka is the spokesman for former Zimbabwe Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. And the Democratic Republic of Congo says it will begin a campaign next month to vaccinate 11.6 million people against yellow fever after an epidemic was declared in the capital. Those stories, plus Mark Ouma's sports, are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama left Liberia last night after visiting the country for about 5 hours on Monday as part of the Let Girls Learn initiative. VOA's James Batty is on assignment in Liberia and filed this report.
U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama has told Liberian girls to stay in school no matter what people may think about them or what challenges they may face, because by staying in school, they can help to change not only Liberia, but the world as a whole.
You all have an important mission as women, and to do that well, you've got to have your education. So no matter what anybody tells you, I want you to keep fighting. Stay in school. Go to secondary school. Go to university if you can. And then when you do all that, I want you to continue to be the leaders that you are and come back to your communities and find other girls just like you who are working and striving and they need your support. We're going to change the way the world thinks about women and girls, aren't we?
Mrs. Obama arrived in Liberia Monday under tight security at Brabos International Airport as part of the Let Girls Learn initiative started in 2015 by she and her husband, President Barack Obama. She was greeted by traditional dancers and a host of Liberian government ministers, including gender, foreign affairs, information, and Liberia's ambassador to the United States. After her arrival, Mrs. Obama held a private meeting with President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. From Brabos Field, Mrs. Obama traveled to Kakata, about 45 miles from Monrovia, where there is a Peace Corps training facility where young volunteers are trained before they are dispersed throughout the country. Peace Corps Director Carrie Hassler-Radley welcomed Peace Corps volunteers back to Liberia and praised them for the valuable job they do. She said the U.S. could not do what it is doing around the world without the Peace Corps.
Thank you for choosing to come to Liberia to serve. You will learn as much or more than you will be actually able to impart. And it's that two-way learning. It's that presence that you have on the ground at the last mile and in deep relationships of trust that you have already built, those of you who have been here for a while, and you will build the trainees among the people. You are there to nurture and catalyze community action. And that is so important.
In Kakata, young Liberian girls involved in the GLOW, or Girls Leading Our World program, told the First Lady that they have learned about leadership, self-esteem, and role models in their program. Mrs. Obama left Liberia last night to Marrakech, Morocco, and Madrid, Spain, to hear more challenges that girls face in those countries. James Botti, VOA News, Monrovia, Liberia.
Zimbabwe's former Prime Minister and Movement for Democratic Change, MDC, founding president Morgan Tsvangirai says he has colon cancer. In a brief statement, Tsvangirai said on the 8th of May 2016, his Zimbabwean doctors referred him to South Africa, where a further diagnosis revealed he was suffering from the cancer of the colon. Following the diagnosis last month, he underwent an operation that was successful. However, he added that a diagnosis of cancer is the first of several medical procedures that include treatment through chemotherapy, which treatment he began this week. He says that as a leader and a public figure, he took the decision to make public his medical condition, adding, quote, "It is my firm belief that the health of national leaders, including politicians, should not be a subject of national speculation and uncertainty." VOA Zimbabwe Service reporter Blessing Zulu spoke to Tsvangirai spokesman Luke Tamborinyoka about the condition of the MDC founding president.
Mr. Tsvangirai is recovering as we speak. He's in South Africa where he's undergoing chemotherapy. As you know, Blessing, he has just issued a statement to the people of Zimbabwe saying that on the 6th of May, he went to South Africa and he was diagnosed with cancer of the colon. But as you know, there are several procedures that are involved after a diagnosis. So as we speak, he went back to South Africa last Sunday and he's undergoing chemotherapy.
Why has he decided to tell the nation about his illness now?
And as far as he is concerned, it speaks to the values that he holds so dear, the values of transparency and honesty. And as you said in his own statement, that true national leadership must always be open about things such as one's state of health. He doesn't believe in secrecy around these matters. And to some of us, it speaks to the quality of leadership.
Luke Tamborinyoka is the spokesman for Zimbabwe's former Prime Minister, Morgan Tsvangirai. The United States has sworn in its first ambassador to Somalia in 25 years. Ambassador Stephen Schwartz took his oath Monday in Washington following his Senate confirmation in May.
Being named the first United States ambassador to Somalia in 25 years is, for me, a profound honor and a great responsibility. But it is also a clear indication of the commitment of the United States to Somalia's success. After two decades of civil strife, Somalis are putting their country back together. And every step of the way, the United States is there as a partner. Progress in the past decade has been steady and significant, but huge challenges remain. We all know that Somalia is beset today by the depredations inflicted by Al-Shabaab, an affiliate of Al-Qaeda, and we mourn those killed over the weekend in the attack at the Nasa Hablod Hotel. Somalia has benefited from the tremendous military support of its African neighbors, as well as assistance from friends around the world. It's time for Somali authorities to establish a responsive and effective Somali National Army to defeat Al-Shabaab and unify the country.
Schwartz, a senior Foreign Service officer who served as Deputy Chief of Missions in Zambia, will replace James Bishop, who left more than two decades ago as the U.S. Embassy came under threat. The U.S. pulled its diplomatic presence and forces out of Somalia in 1993. After militiamen shot down a U.S. military helicopter, killing 18 soldiers. The Al-Shabaab extremist group emerged out of the country's civil chaos of that time. In recent years, the group has been ousted from Somalia's major cities, although it has continued to launch attacks. New York City, perhaps the most ethnically diverse city in the world, has seen a huge upsurge in immigration from Africa in recent decades. Many have landed in Harlem. Members of the diverse African diaspora face many rewards and challenges as they try to make new lives for themselves there. These include the forging of a workable coexistence with the African-American community that has dominated the district for nearly a century. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke to Khalil Gibran Muhammad, the outgoing director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, America's premier institution dedicated to the African diaspora experience.
The African diaspora and communities of New York are much more diverse than we like to give them credit for, as is Africa. It's not only diverse by virtue of nationality, where people come from, but it's also diverse by virtue of class and the kinship networks that they're drawing upon. You often have first-generation immigrants. They are essentially making their way in America for the first time, not unlike long immigration patterns in this country. You often find communities of laborers and small business owners, people who are essentially increasing their living standard by virtue of disadvantage where they come from, but also in this country very much at the beginning end of the economic ladder. But they're content because they're able to recreate their cultural community on this land. And up till now, they still have a substantial foothold as prominent members of a subdivision of Harlem. Now, Nigerians, for example, tend to be more overrepresented among the striving classes of African immigrant populations, and certainly in higher education and among our sort of nouveau riche of African immigrants. You see them showing up in journalism. We've had a couple of major media outlets funded by Nigerian wealth. And I would argue there's also one final class, which is the kind of literary class. And so there's been an explosion of African writers. Chimamanda Adichie might be the most prominent of these, also a Nigerian immigrant here in the United States. They're bringing both their African sensibilities, but also pretty fascinating critiques of America, and really talking about how race is constructed on the backs of the bodies of people of African descent, which often strikes people in the continent once they get here as bizarre. They have to come here to learn that they're actually black. For post-colonial Africans, the relationship to colonialism, it's a historical thing, not a reality. So for those young people, they have to come here to all of a sudden realize how white people treat black people presumptively as less than. And I've had this conversation with several African students on college campuses where they talk about what it means to show up in America, never even thinking about you being black, and all of a sudden white students are making all sorts of assumptions about, you know, how smart they are or what kind of music they like to listen to or how they live, et cetera, et cetera. But their class attitudes often can be at odds with the kind of working class ethos of some African American populations who have a much more robust critique of inequality in America versus some Nigerian Americans who see the problem not with the country but with your individual inputs. You know, you sort of get out of this country what you put into it.
Yes, we know that relations between native-born Africans and African-Americans can be quite strained sometimes.
The relationships between African immigrants and African-Americans are often fractured or tense. The old culture of Pan-Africanism, which flowered in the 1960s and 70s, has shifted dramatically. There, it was both about a kind of pride in blackness and a recovery of the lost connection to the continent, and people like Stokely Carmichael, who became Kwame Ture, who married Miriam Makeba, epitomized this sort of flowering of the continent and the United States. And Harry Belafonte, who spent a lot of time on the continent, is still with us. It's hard to think of either a kind of activist today or a cultural figure today with the same kind of credibility for spending time on the continent and really cultivating relationships. It's also true, and you know, this is sort of the ugly side of it, African Americans have long stereotyped and stigmatized Africans as being inferior and less than, and it almost a source of sort of self-shame for the relationship to Africa. While at the same time, African immigrants have often thought about black Americans as being whiners and complainers and not really fully taking advantage of the opportunities that America has. So there's a lot of confusion on both sides. And really, the Schomburg Center is built to be a place to help educate both sides of that conversation and to empower both groups with a better sense of both the complexities and the commonalities that exist between them.
That was Khalil Gibran Muhammad, the outgoing director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. He was speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Nigeria's government wants to go to the bargaining table with militants in its oil-producing Niger Delta. But activists are divided whether negotiations will bring peace or encourage more militancy. Chris Stein reports with Hilary Aguru in Awori, Nigeria.
To some, meeting with the Niger Delta Avengers is the surest way to head off a bloody military confrontation between the group and Nigeria's military. Godspower Gebenekama is a member of the traditional ruling council in the Gbaramatu kingdom, which has been the site of several attacks on pipelines.
Military's solution is never a solution and can never be a solution. Dialogue is the only way forward.
But to others, talks would simply encourage people in the oil-rich but poor region to take up arms as a way to extract concessions from the government. Attorney Ogene Jabor Ekimi is a human rights activist in the city of Warri.
If not because I'm a lawyer, if I were living in the creeks, I would just form my own too. And then so that government can come and dialogue with me. But there's no sense in all this.
This would not be the first time Nigeria has gone to the bargaining table with militants in the Niger Delta. A similar insurgency calmed in 2009 when the government started paying off militants and offering them job training in exchange for peace. Talks with the Avengers may have already started to bear fruit. An official at the state-run oil company told VOA last week the Avengers have agreed to a ceasefire with the government, though the group denied any agreement. Months of attacks by the Avengers dropped Nigeria's oil production per day by as much as half. Junior Petroleum Minister Emmanuel Ibe-Kachikwu told Bloomberg News this week that production had mostly recovered. The Avengers have demanded more development for the Niger Delta, but they've also branched into calling for the release of a jailed separatist leader. During the weekend, they said on Twitter that Nigeria should hold a referendum on breaking into separate countries, much as the United Kingdom just voted to leave the European Union. Institute of Human Rights and Humanitarian Law Director Anyakwe Nsirimovu says heeding the militants' demands will simply lead to more militants.
Anybody from anywhere can just pick AK-47, create hell in the pipelines, and expect the federal government to come and negotiate with them. That would be anarchy.
As the Avengers have grown in profile, various other militant groups have emerged with their own demands for President Muhammadu Buhari and his government. Ekimi said the best option for ending the militancy would be what militants and activists alike have been demanding all along, develop the Niger Delta.
Don't even dialogue with any of this group. Just start your development. All this group will fizzle out.
But with the economy heading for a recession and the military committed to fighting the Islamist Boko Haram insurgency in the Northeast, dialogue may be the Buhari administration's only option. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
The Democratic Republic of Congo says it will begin a campaign next month to vaccinate 11.6 million people against yellow fever after an epidemic was declared in the capital. Health Minister Felix Kabange says that the campaign will begin on July 20th and will aim to vaccinate everyone in the capital of Kinshasa except children under 9 months. The campaign will also target populations in the provinces of Kwango, Lualaba, and Kasai. Last week, Congo's government announced an epidemic in the capital Kinshasa and other provinces after reporting 67 confirmed cases of yellow fever and more than 1,000 other suspected cases. An outbreak in neighboring Angola has led to the death of about 345 people. The WHO announced last week that it plans to vaccinate people along the border between Angola and the Democratic Republic of Congo and said it is working with vaccine manufacturers to increase production. In addition to the DRC, the outbreak of yellow fever in Angola has been linked to cases in China and Kenya. The disease is also prevalent in South America, where several countries have current cases. German, French, and Italian leaders indicate that there will be no formal or informal talks with Britain until it triggers Article 50, the clause that formally sets in motion the two-year period for it to leave the European Union. Lisa Bryant has more.
The message sent by German, French, and Italian leaders was clear. No formal or informal talks with Britain until it triggers Article 50, the clause that formally sets in motion the two-year period for it to leave the European Union. That point was stressed by German Chancellor Angela Merkel at a press conference in Berlin, delivering a blow to hopes by some pro-Brexit leaders.
As long as this request has not been placed with the European Union, no measure can be taken.
That's not expected to happen until after a replacement is chosen for British Prime Minister David Cameron, probably in September. Merkel spoke after the three heads of state met to form a common position as chaos spreads across Britain, the EU, and financial markets after Britain's voted last week to leave the 28-member bloc. The three leaders also outlined priorities, security, growth and jobs, youth, and the eurozone, that they believe the EU should focus on ahead of a two-day summit in Brussels on moving ahead without Britain. Despite the show of unity, there are mixed messages. While Merkel calls for a measured process, French President François Hollande is among those urging a speedy outcome in breaking the ties. It's important not to waste time, he says, because nothing is worse than uncertainty. It generates irrational political and financial behavior, and the UK is experiencing this, he added. The Brexit vote has plunged Europe into an unprecedented crisis, sparking calls by some some Europeans to follow suit and others for major reforms. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, meeting with European and British leaders Monday, warned EU members against being revengeful. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And now it's time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Jackson. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with athletics. Kenya's Alice Aprot won women's 10,000 meters in 30 minutes and 26.94 seconds at the Africa Senior Athletics Championships on Saturday night. Besides setting a personal best and a championship record, Aprot ran the world's quickest time for the event this year. She set such a pace which lifted the next four athletes to run their lifetime bests and qualify for the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. They were Kenyans Jacqueline Chepngeno and Jocelyn Jepkosgei, Rwanda's Salome Nyirarukunda, and Ethiopian Demisa Ware. On the infield, Nigerian Tosin Oke reclaimed the Africa men's triple jump title he won in 2010 and 2012 with an Olympic qualifier of 17 meters and 13 centimeters. Meanwhile, Zimbabwean multiple swimming Olympic medalist Kirsty Coventry was crowned Sportswoman of the Year at the inaugural Africa Union Sports Council AUCS Region 5 Annual Awards in Johannesburg, South Africa on Friday. Coventry earned the accolade for the three gold medals when she triumphed in 100 meters and 200 meters backstroke, as well as the 200 meter individual medley event at the 2015 All-Africa Games in Brazzaville in the Republic of Congo. The Sportsman of the Year award went to South African Wade van Niekerk, who won the 400 meters at the 2015 World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China. Zambia received a special award for Region 5 for their leading role in implementing AUCS programs. The AUCS Regional 5 General Manager Stanley Mutonya told the media in Johannesburg. Region 5 includes Angola, Botswana, Lesotho, Malawi, Mozambique, Namibia, South Africa, Swaziland, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. Egypt's Al Ahly host Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosa in an Orange Africa Champions League tie in Alexandria today, Tuesday. Elsewhere, in the Orange Africa Confederations Cup action, Tanzania's Young Africans welcomed the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe to Dar es Salaam as Libya's Al Ahly Tripoli engaged Morocco's Kaukab Marrakech. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Eteguini, South Africa. Back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark, and have a good day. And that's it for this Tuesday, June 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters James Batty, as well as sports editor Marco Wuma, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com,
The news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.